It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we sit down for a conversation with a guest who's been called the greatest female athlete of all time.
First, we're getting an update on the Ebola outbreak. Today, the first patient diagnosed with Ebola in the United States has died. The Liberian man was being treated in Dallas, and his condition worsened in recent days.
Federal officials also just announced they'll start screening for fevers among passengers arriving from West Africa in 5 U.S. airports. We have Tony Goldberg with us to talk about the disease, what the United States and the world is doing to try to limit the outbreak. He's a professor of epidemiology in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine and associate director for research at the UW-Madison Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Very nice to be here, Rob. Thanks.
We'll mention two different sides of your job, one animal health, one human health. And let's start there. What are the animal origins, if there are animal origins, of Ebola?
Well, that's a good question because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, why would a veterinarian be talking about this subject? Well, our best guess is that Ebola is a virus that naturally lives in animals, and only on occasion does it pass into people and cause problems. So this is an example, we think, of a zoonotic disease, an animal disease that people can catch. The difference with this one is it's particularly severe.
And what is it about Ebola that makes it so severe? Easy to transmit, high mortality rate? What are the big things we worry about here?
Well, the thing that stands out about Ebola, it's really two things. First of all, it's a really serious illness. If you have Ebola fever, you're in big trouble. We talk about case fatality rates being the probability that you're going to die if you get a disease. With Ebola, it's upwards of 50%, which is really high. So as diseases go, it's just a scary one. The other thing that's unusual about Ebola relative to a lot of other zoonotic diseases is that once it's caught by a person, they can transmit it to another person. Mm-hmm. So we have zoonoses here in Wisconsin, for example, Lyme disease or West Nile virus. But in those cases, they really can't be transmitted person to person. Ebola is different. So it's almost gotten to the next stage of the epidemic just by its basic biology.
And how, as far as transmissibility from human to human, how easily does it make the jump from one person to another, again, compared to other diseases?
Well, that's imperfectly known, but from the experiences with this epidemic, all things considered, it's not that difficult. So if somebody has Ebola and they're shedding virus actively, which happens when they have a fever, then it seems pretty easy for people to catch Ebola if they touch that person or their bodily fluids.
So that's part of the problem in West Africa. And now what we're worried about here in the United States is we see our first few cases coming over to the country.
That's right. So in West Africa, the epidemic has spread largely because of traditional practices of preparing dead for funerals. So people come into close contact with people who've recently died of Ebola or are sick. And there's also been a lot of transmission to healthcare workers who, of course, are getting very close to people with illness.
And that's an issue I wanted to get into with you. Last time we had you on, you talked about a different disease and changing cultural norms to stop catching that disease and transmitting it. Are there things along those lines now that have been successful, could be successful in changing the way people behave to try to arrest the spread of the disease?
Absolutely there are, yeah. I think what we're seeing right now is the rapid response to a crisis. But when that crisis passes, and it will, I think what we're going to see is a really serious reevaluation of how we approach international public health. So I think there should at least be efforts focused on what were the breakdowns in public health education right at the local level in some of these endemic areas in Liberia and the surrounding countries, because that's really the primary level of intervention.
And one of the main ways, as I've heard, that the disease spread initially was because of burial practices in places like Guinea. And the traditional way corpses were dealt with transmitted the disease to friends and family.
That's correct. These are traditional practices, so they're important because they're part of the culture. And part of that, to respect the dead, involves preparing and washing the dead prior to a funeral. Now, in an Ebola-free location, that's fine. But when a disease like Ebola is present, that's really a recipe for disaster. So to block that mode of transmission would take some concerted education.
And that's a public health challenge, isn't it? Saying, okay, we've got this disease going around. You need to do something very differently, possibly something that's alien, maybe even offensive to you, you know, in terms of handing over the body of your loved one to these guys in these weird suits.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's been shown time and time again that human behavior can be very difficult to change. You know, we're set in our ways. There have been studies, for example, of hand washing, where we try very hard to get people to wash their hands just a little bit more, and it takes a lot of effort to get even a few percentage more hand washing. So I think when you're dealing with very important, deeply ingrained cultural practices, you're going to come across these barriers. By the same token, people now understand this is important, and I think there'll be more willingness for people to change their behavior because of the severity of this disease.
Now, of course, we're trying to tackle this on the government level here. We've been hearing in the news the U.S. government is going to start checking travelers from West Africa for fever at a handful of airports. Does this seem like at least a step in the right direction?
I think it does. We have high-risk populations for Ebola. They're people who originate from the countries in West Africa that are affected. I think it makes perfect sense to pay special attention to those individuals because they're most likely to be carrying the virus.
And that first patient was initially, I understand, sent home from the hospital. There's one place where maybe we need a cultural change at our hospitals, changing protocols to ask questions like, where did you come here from? Were you exposed to Ebola? Are we moving quickly enough in that direction?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of the attention's been focused on changing cultural practices, behaviors, and responses in Africa, in the endemic countries. But I think the situation in Dallas illustrated some pretty important breakdowns in our own public health system. That patient who came to that hospital should not have been sent home. And I think everybody recognizes that now. So I think it's a test for us in the coming weeks, months, and years. Are we going to be able to fix the broken parts of our own public health system?
Now, one worrisome thing is the risk that healthcare providers take dealing with this, either in West Africa, mainly there, but also this one case of transmission in Spain now was a healthcare worker working with someone who'd come back from West Africa and a chance contamination, really. How hard is it for the international community to keep getting healthcare workers to go and work in a situation like this where they're putting themselves at great risk potentially?
It's extremely difficult. That's one of the challenges that the current outbreak is facing. I think that's one of the reasons why we've activated parts of our military to go over there, because there is a shortage of healthcare workers, both because they're in Liberia, there really are very few healthcare workers to begin with. Some of them have gotten sick, and the ones who haven't are justifiably scared. If I were in that position, I'd be scared too.
We're talking to epidemiologist Tony Goldberg about Ebola, in part what the United States is doing to prevent an outbreak, lessons we can learn from future outbreaks in the initial response in the early days of this disease spreading in West Africa.
We're continuing our conversation about what the U.S. is doing to prevent an Ebola outbreak with epidemiologist Tony Goldberg.
And you can join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions. Are you concerned about a potential outbreak maybe here in the United States? Why or why not? Do you have questions about the disease? Are you in touch with people you know in West Africa? Can you share what you've heard from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. Tony, with an outbreak like this, I assume a lot of people are wondering, is it possible that there could be a vaccine or a treatment or a cure or something like that? How hard is it to find any of those things for a disease like Ebola?
Well, That's an interesting question too, Rob, because actually we have some very promising candidate vaccines. There are at least two that seem to be very effective, and I'm quite sure that we're going to be seeing those getting to the final stages of clinical trials soon. And in terms of treatments, there was this quote-unquote experimental treatment that was tried on the U.S. physician who got Ebola and was flown back to Atlanta. So we also have treatments that can help. I don't think the reason we're seeing an epidemic in this case is because of lack of treatment options or even lack of vaccines. I think it's more breakdowns in public health.
And are there diseases in the neighborhood of Ebola that we might be learning lessons from? It seems like it's really different from the big pandemic influenzas that we've seen in the past. Or is it more similar than I think?
Well, I mean, it's similar and it's different. Influenza is another example of a disease that originates in animals. One key difference, though, is that influenza is a virus that naturally lives in our respiratory systems and is transmitted by coughing and sneezing and aerosols. Ebola is not. Ebola needs direct contact. So their modes of transmission, as we say, are quite different. And actually that works in our favor in this case.
So it's a little harder to transmit Ebola than a flu or even a common cold, for that matter.
Yeah, our current understanding is that it would be more difficult to transmit Ebola because it doesn't aerosolize. You couldn't sit in a room with someone without any contact with them or their bodily fluids, presumably, and get Ebola.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Marie in Wausau on the line. Marie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually have a little observation that leads into my question. My husband, who's traveled for work for a couple of decades, for the first time he's seen men actually wash their hands in the restrooms at O'Hare. And when he made a comment about it, one of the guys muttered about Ebola. Why, as an epidemiologist, what recommendations do you have for how do you talk to people figuring out when these small changes can make a difference? And why does it take something like Ebola killing people across the world to make the difference, whereas flu is much more likely to hit someone here in the States?
Marie, thanks for that observational data. Tony, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think the caller's observation is exactly right. There have been changes in the way people perceive infection and health as a result of the news coming out of this outbreak. And I think it's because it's just so scary. And sometimes it takes fear to motivate people to change their core behaviors. I do international research in Uganda, and I've been there near the times of certain past Ebola outbreaks, and you'll see changes like that happening on the ground. People are less likely to go out into big crowds. They don't want to shake hands as often. So for scary diseases like this, there is clear benefit to these things. I think the caller raises an interesting point, though. Why can't we get the same motivation for diseases that are maybe a little bit less severe, but much more common, like the flu?
We could make a difference on things like flu by more frequent hand washing?
We could. You know, simple things like hand washing are actually quite effective, whether with soap or these little alcohol-based hand sanitizers or even just with water. If you do it right, you can really disinfect your hands quite well. And I'm not sure that anyone has done any research with Ebola that way, but it is a virus. We know a lot about viruses in general. So one would assume that little things like that, decontamination, hygiene, could help.
Marie, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jack with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jack?
When I listen to how you can catch Ebola, it seems very similar to catching HIV. And my question is, how come it seems to be easier to catch Ebola than it does HIV?
Oh, interesting, Jack. Any thoughts on that, Tony?
Yeah, well, again, it gets to this point of the mode of transmission. So in HIV, the mode is clearly sexual, so you need sexual contact. In the case of Ebola, it's not. Now, sexual transmission is possible, but really it's touching bodily fluids, getting them on cuts on your hands or in your mucous membrane or in your mouth or eyes. So there are many more options, in a sense, for Ebola to pass from person to person than for HIV, which I guess explains part of this difference.
Now, I know, Tony, you mentioned fear as a motivator for good behavior like hand washing and things like that. But I know in epidemics throughout human history, sometimes fear amplifies the damage that a disease can do. How do we straddle that line?
That's a great observation. And you're absolutely right. The typical human reaction when epidemics get out of hand is to flee. And we're actually seeing that in some of the endemic countries and some of the villages where people are, again, very justifiably afraid of Ebola and afraid of, suddenly these people showing up in white bodysuits. Their reaction is to flee to neighboring villages or even flee across the border. And these are areas of the world where borders are not enforced and there's really no formal authorities to block people's movements. So what you get is the spread of an epidemic because of that fear.
And how important is it to keep up public health systems where they exist? But also, do you worry about, as that fear spreads, breakdowns in things like sanitation, in food systems and things like that, making people more at risk for maybe other diseases?
That's a great point. There's been a lot of talk about that in the public health community. Ebola has basically brought an entire nation's economy or several nations' economies to a standstill and has really disrupted society. So if you're a person, for example, right now who's sick in Liberia with malaria, which is a deadly disease, there are no hospitals for you to go to. So the access that people have normally, which still isn't very great, mm-hmm. to healthcare for basic diseases has also collapsed because of these challenges to public health infrastructure.
Well, a story we'll keep following. Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That was Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine and associate director for research at the UW-Madison Global Health Institute, with us to talk about the Ebola outbreak, what the U.S., what the world is doing to try to slow that outbreak down.